I'm a left-handed man, so you know about those. But in any case, I always profit from these studies, as I was saying, and the last few years with helping with the teaching, I learn a lot in preparation, but then I learn a lot more as I hear you interact with the material. So I'm looking forward to you doing that. I come not as an expert, save for the fact that I was recently quoted on Facebook, and it wasn't original with me. That makes it doubly ironic. But the quote was that if you travel more than 200 miles and carry a briefcase, then you're an expert. And I said that whimsically in a message, and one of my friends equally whimsically put it on Facebook later, naming me as the source, which I wasn't. But there you are. So I'm no expert, and I'll look forward to your contributions when we come to the discussion time especially, although if the Spirit leads and if time permits, I might open up and give you opportunity even during my regular sessions. It's no holds barred here this year. I knew that, and I always know that, but when the very first session, the very first minute of the study, Henry turned to one of my passages that I'm assigned for tomorrow, I knew that's it. Just half of what I've prepared for is out the window. So, but that's okay. We've enjoyed what the Lord had to say through Brother Henry. I thought it might be helpful not to spend a great deal of time on this, but just to begin by looking at a few outlines of the book of Deuteronomy. And there are many good ones. Even this morning, someone emailed me one by our brother David Gooding that's not included in this slideshow. If you would like these and any others I might have assembled, just let me know. I can email them to you, or if you have a computer here, we can transfer them over physically by one of those little USB sticks. Or if you need it in hard copy even, we can get it printed out, no doubt. So if you'd like copies of these, don't worry. That can be arranged. Don't break your hand trying to write them all down quickly. The first one, the print is a little bit small. I apologize for that, but this is from Brother Warren Wiersbe. I hear once in a while Ravi Zacharias tells the story about Billy Graham in his very early days as an evangelist with Youth for Christ. He was supposed to be following around another evangelist who was much better known, and a school had invited this much better known evangelist than Billy Graham to come and speak, and he couldn't come. So he said, I'll send you a young man in my place. They said, who is he? They said, Billy Graham. Imagine. They said, we never heard of him. And they said, send him along anyway. So he went along and he preached, and he came back, and the older evangelist asked him, well, how did it go? And Billy said, well, not so well. Only one person, you know, professed faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. But that one person was Warren Wiersbe, and he's written commentaries on every book of the Bible. So one of the men that our late brother, Mr. Tiernis Wilson, would have described as a five-talent man. But in any case, he has a way of putting down in a pithy style the contents of a book that I find helpful. You may not be a pea shooter and be into alliteration. I know Randy Amos likes that a little bit, so this will appeal to him. But it is helpful, you know, and here he breaks down the book broadly into historical concerns. Moses looks back, and those are chapters 1 through 4. And then the second section will be practical concerns. Moses looks within. Those are chapters 5 through 26. And then we have prophetical concerns. Moses looks ahead, chapters 27 through 30. And personal concerns, Moses looks up, chapters 31 through 34. And he gives you little descriptions of the chapters in between those broad headings. So I commend that outline to you. It's certainly a helpful way of doing it. Now, Meredith Klein was actually a man, not a woman, in spite of the unfortunate first name. Thank the Lord in grace he was saved, because it would take a lot of grace to forgive my parents for that one. But in any case, Brother Klein came up with a outline that follows a lot of the same contours of section, but he looks at it from the standpoint of a covenant. Because after all, Israel was in a covenant with the Lord. They had a contract with him, if you will, that we've already heard some things said about this weekend. And so you have the preamble, the covenant mediator, in the first five verses of the book. And then we come to the historical prologue, the covenant history, That's chapters 1, verse 6 through 449. Then we come to the covenant stipulations, which have to do with covenant life, the great commandment in chapters 5 through 11, and ancillary commandments in chapters 12 through 26. Then the covenant sanctions, covenant ratification, blessings and curses, covenant oath, chapters 27 through 30. And finally, dynastic disposition, covenant continuity, chapters 31 through 34. Now, another scholar named Paul House has come up with a similar division that follow a lot of the four sections of the book that those other brothers have been following. And he describes it here in this paragraph. After a historical and geographical notation opens the book, Moses addresses the people concerning their history, concerning their covenant with God, concerning the renewal of their covenant with the Lord or Yahweh. These three sermonic interpretations of history and covenant relationships are followed by a transfer of power from Moses to Joshua, the production of the book of the law, Moses' blessing of Israel, and Moses' death, chapters 31 through 34. History, covenant, and transition dominate the book in a way that teaches the new generation to expect God to act decisively on their behalf because of similar acts in the past. Current divine demands of obedience are anchored firmly in God's grace, God's revelation, and God's promises. Much of this has been said already by our three brothers in different ways, but that puts it just in paragraph form for you. Then there are ancient historians who've noticed that the book of Deuteronomy really represents or resembles a suzerain treaty. Now, the concept of suzerainty is that you have one kingdom that, let's say, is the big bad boy on the block. They are the superpower of the region. And the other smaller kingdoms around it tremble. And they sit down and they figure out that they can't meet the enemy in battle. And so they sue for peace. And the big bad king says, well, I'll give you peace, all right. I won't invade you. I won't trash you, as long as you sign this treaty with me. And the treaty will be that you recognize me as your king. I'm the sovereign over you, and you must obey me, and here are your obligations. And the treaty structure actually follows this pattern of preamble, historical prologue, general stipulations, specific stipulations, blessings and curses, a document clause, and witnesses. And you'll see that there are correspondences in Deuteronomy to all those different sections. So the point being that the very way God has put together the book of Deuteronomy shows us, number one, that he is greater than the recipients of the book. Greater initially than the nation of Israel, first of all, but we'd describe it this way. We'd say he is Lord. In other words, he's the one who has the place of eminence and preeminence. And he's the one who can command and must be obeyed. And he's the one who undertakes certain obligations on behalf of his people, but then he expects certain behavior in return. So even the way the Lord puts together the book of Deuteronomy was in a way that in the culture and time and place in which it was received, underscored for them the greatness of the Lord, and that he was to be obeyed. Or as Brother Henry put it earlier, one of the main concepts of the book is the fear of the Lord. The understanding that God is greater than we are, that he is supreme, and he must be obeyed. I believe that came out of the ESV Study Bible, by the way, so if you have the ESV Study Bible, that'll look familiar. Now, this is much less professional than the other outlines. This is just my simple topical outline of chapter 2, which is what we're going to deal with now. And all I've done basically is try in a few phrases to describe the contents of the chapter. And so in verses 1 through 12, we have instructions for traveling through Edomite and Moabite territory. Then in verses 13 through 17, you get the crossing of Zered, leaving Kadesh Barnea with a reference back to the perishing of the condemned generation. Then we pick up again with stipulations about how they were to behave in Ammonite territory, verses 18 through 23. And finally, the story of the defeat of Sihon the Ammonite king from the city of Heshbon. And so that basically breaks down for us the content of chapter 2. Now we'll look to the detail. And again, feel free to ask me later and I'll happily email to you or get those outlines to you, and plus the one by Gooding and a couple others I've come across that weren't in these slides, if you desire it. Now let's look at chapter 2, Deuteronomy chapter 2. Deuteronomy 2. And maybe some brother, to save my voice, because I'm recovering from a cold, some brother could get the mic that's usually used for contributions. And if you could just read for us, please, the first 12 verses, that would be helpful. If you could get the mic and read the first 12 verses.
Hello? Deuteronomy chapter 2, starting in verse 1. Then we turned and journeyed into the wilderness of the way of the Red Sea, as the Lord spoke to me, and we skirted Mount Seir for many days. And the Lord spoke to me, saying, You have skirted this mountain long enough. Turn northward, and command the people, saying, You are about to pass through the territory of your brethren, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir, and they will be afraid of you. Therefore, watch yourselves carefully. Do not meddle with them, for I will not give you any of their land. No, not so much as one footstep, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau and as a possession. In verse 6, You shall buy food from them with money that you may eat, and you shall also buy water from them with money that you may drink.
On to verse 12, please.
Verse 7, For the Lord your God has blessed you in all the work of your hand. He knows you're trudging through this great wilderness. These 40 years the Lord your God has been with you. You have lacked nothing. And when we pass beyond our brethren, the descendants of Esau who dwell in Seir, away from the road of the plain, away from Eloth and Ezion Geber, we turned and passed by the way of the wilderness of Moab. Then the Lord said to me, Do not harass Moab, nor contend with them in battle, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession. Because I have given Ar to the descendants of Lot as a possession. The Emen had dwelt there in times past, a people as great and numerous and tall as the Anakim. They were also regarded as giants, like the Anakim, but the Moabites called them Emen. In verse 12, The Horites formerly dwelt in Seir, but the descendants of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them, and dwelt in their place, just as Israel did to the land of their possessions, which the Lord gave them.
Thank you very much. Just a procedural note before I launch into the detail here. Chapter 2 and chapter 3, which I'm also responsible for, are quite disproportionate in size. So I'm going to try to stick to the time allotted to me on the outlines. Thank you. And don't worry if we're not nearly through chapter 2 when I end this session, because I have the next session after the break, so we'll finish up chapter 2 and do chapter 3 in the next session if we haven't finished 2 in this session. In any case, what these verses that have just been read to us show us is that the movements of the nation of Israel were carefully dictated by the Lord. Proverbs has a verse that tells us, A man's heart plans his way, but the Lord orders his steps. And if Israel had had their druthers, of course, they would have gone into the land some 38 years before. Of course, they only had themselves to blame, as we heard earlier. It was through their own unbelief. They looked at the land. They said, yes, it's fruitful. Yes, it's a good land. Yes, it's just as advertised, the land flowing with milk and honey. It's not like some vacation resorts that you can go to that you look on the brochure and they've got the beautiful pictures of waterfalls and swimming pools, and you get there and you find out it's completely different than the brochure. But not so the land of promise. They got there and they said, it's just as advertised. You're right, Lord. It's a beautiful, wonderful, fruitful country. And yet we can't go up and take it. Why? Well, they're giants. And we're like grasshoppers in their sight. And my favorite comment in Numbers 13, and we were like grasshoppers in their sight. Now that gives me an interesting concept of espionage. You know, I'm kind of attracted to reading spy novels, and even better, reading about real intelligence work through the years. And I'm trying to imagine the spies that might go into a land that would flag down a giant and say, "You, excuse me, what do you think we look like to you? Would you say we look like a small varmint, perhaps a groundhog? Or do you think it's more on the order of a grasshopper?" Grasshopper? Oh. Three out of four giants say, "We look like grasshoppers." I really doubt they did that. In other words, their imagination ran away with them. That they began thinking, "We're so small. We're like little bugs compared to these guys. And that surely must be how we look to them and what they'll think of us." When it's ironic that later in the book of Joshua, when the conquest actually begins, and they come to Jericho, and there the spies enter, and they're being entertained by Rahab. And Rahab says, "We heard the report of all that your God did to Egypt, and I don't want that to happen to me, or to my family, or anybody that pertains to me. Will you show me mercy?" So the way the enemies, at least some of them, looked on them was quite different than what they imagined. And yet in their fear, they build it up so much that they said, "We can't go in, we'll be killed, and really, lest you think we're being cowardly, we're thinking about our children." Now, children get blamed for a lot of things by their parents, you know? They can be an excuse for being late to the meeting. They can be an excuse for eating too much. They can be an excuse for substance abuse in extreme cases. They can be, I'm thinking of that classic lyric, "Son, you're going to drive me to drinking if you don't stop driving that hot rod Lincoln." But more seriously, I've had people say to us, "Well, we're leaving this assembly because it's for our children, you know. We got to go somewhere else for our children." Now, frankly, not every place trying to be a New Testament assembly has always been a great place for children, unfortunately. And many assemblies have problems, and parents might well be given pause as they think about taking their children to the assembly and subjecting them to problems. But what an education it would be if our children would see us committed to the assembly and throwing ourselves into the work of the Lord there and saying, quite frankly, "Yes, there are problems here. But by God's grace, I want to be one of the instruments of correcting the problems. I want to be a means of stirring up this place to be a more godly place." And what a different testimony that would be to our children, rather than saying, "We're going to go over here where it's easier. We're going to go over here where it's more socially acceptable. We're going to go over here to this place where it's more popular or more exciting," or whatever the case may be. What are we telling them about our commitment to the Lord if we do such things? We have to be willing to endure some hardship and even to face some dangers if we're going to do the work the Lord wants us to do. But they pointed at their children and said, "Think of how poor Reuben would get on without me as his father, you know? He'd grow up without a father, and that would be a fate worse than anything. Better have a live grasshopper as a father than a dead squashed bug in the land of Canaan." Except there was no thought of them being squashed, was there? Because it was all about the power of the Lord. If they were to get the land, it must be by dependence on the Lord. And so because of their unbelief for those many years in the wilderness, they traveled around and bit by bit they died off. We'll read about that farther on in the chapter. But now finally, in very terse style, "Then we turned and journeyed into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea as the Lord spoke to me, and we skirted Mount Seir for many days. And the Lord spoke to me saying, 'You have skirted this mountain long enough, turn northward.'" So they had been going away from the land of promise. And the Lord says, now's the time, turn back. And now's going to be the time when you're going to enter in. Except the wonderful thing is that God doesn't bring them in and throw them in at the deep end, first of all. He's going to bring them in and very carefully show them His mindset toward things and do certain things which are calculated to prepare them for the service and the battles ahead. And sometimes it's as much how God does a thing as the end result that's important. We heard earlier about results and how deceiving they can be. God cares about the process as well as about the result. In other words, it's not Machiavellian. It's not the end justifies the means. Or to use Larry the Cable Guy theology, get her done. However you get it done, that's all that matters. No, not so, says the Lord. Do it the Lord's way. Do it the way the Lord prescribes. That is the way of blessing, because it is the way that brings God glory and that acknowledges that God is the sovereign Lord, that He's the one in command. So they turned and commanded the people, saying, verse 4, you are about to pass through the territory of your brethren, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir, and they will be afraid of you. Therefore, watch yourselves carefully. Now, the natural man would say, well, fear, that's a good thing, isn't it? If my enemy fears me, that gives me a psychological advantage. We have whole divisions of our military that are given today to something called PsyOps, psychological operations, that is, to try and do things to mess with the head of the enemy and to make the enemy a bit afraid. I mean, that's been done throughout history. You know, the Carthaginian general Hannibal used his elephants not just to get over the Alps, but it was especially the fear factor associated that when the troops, the enemy troops, saw the elephants, they'd be dismayed seeing these behemoths come at them, you know? And it would cause panic and confusion in the ranks. Here's Esau, and the Lord says, they're going to be afraid of you. But because they're afraid of you, He tells them, do not meddle with them, verse 5. For I will not give you any other land, no, not so much as one footstep, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession. Now sometimes the way believers go about fighting the Lord's battles doesn't show this kind of wisdom. Sometimes we feel like we got to put on a strong face. And since the enemies of the gospel are intellectual, we must meet them on their own ground and be equally intellectual. Well, God isn't against the intellect, after all. This very book tells us that we're to love the Lord our God with our minds. But at the end of the day, it's not about how many PhDs we have versus how many PhD the other side has. It's about truth and promoting the truth. It's not about how many political people we can get on our side and advance our agenda and use all kinds of means that make the world see what kind of power and clout we have. I mean, look at how we put President George W. Bush into office for the second term. And after he won by a landslide, the media was shocked. How could this happen? And they turned around and they noted the evangelical vote. And suddenly, evangelicals were being described in the mainstream media as kingmakers. That who they anointed and set up, those would be candidates to be contended with. And yet, when professing Christians do that, it doesn't necessarily endear us to the world, does it? And it often engenders fear out there that we have some kind of political agenda for the United States, rather than a spiritual agenda in seeing men and women brought to Christ. Now, I realize there are different convictions among Christians among how much one may participate in the political process, and I'm not intending to take that up here. I'm just saying, by the techniques we've seen used in the last 15 years in America, it shows how evangelicals can scare the world terribly. And yet it doesn't advance the gospel one bit. You have to be very careful of that. Because we can be kingmakers one day and we can be blamed for the ills of the country the next. And to some people, to mention the United States is to think about that, quote, evangelical president, end quote, who started the war in Iraq and did this and did that and so forth and so on. Now, whether the man's an evangelical or not, I'm not sitting in judgment on that here. But I'm saying by tying our horse to the political wagon, we scare the world and we confuse the gospel. The Lord said, don't mess with the Edomites. I don't want you to meddle with them. I don't want you to exploit their fear. I want you to go out of your way not to provoke them. You're going to go by the highway of the Arabah there, and as you come through their territory, you're going to buy water and food for them. Don't threaten them. Don't cajole them. You're to be people that approach them peaceably. Why? Because I'm not going to give you their land. Because the Lord flat out says right there in verse 5, I have given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession. Now that's a wondrous thing. That Esau, or Edom as his kingdom came to be known, was a man who in his own way was so uncouth and so vulgar. He didn't esteem spiritual things. He lived for this world. He lived for instant gratification. He lived for the pleasures that he could have now. And yet God had Isaac give him a blessing as well, didn't he? Oh, it wasn't the chief blessing. That went to Jacob and to Israel, his descendancy. But in Genesis 27, Esau did get a blessing. And he was going to dwell in fruitful lands. But he wouldn't be as great as his brother. Eventually, his brother would rule over him. Not in their lifetimes, but in their descendants. During King David's reign, for example. During Solomon's reign. During the reign of some of the subsequent kings. Edom would become a vassal state to Israel. And when they had grown tired of that, they would throw off their yoke. Well, how gracious is God. That even to such a one as to Esau and to the Edomites, who by and large as a people were not very spiritual and not very helpful to God's people over the long course of their history, nevertheless God would say, I've given them a place, I've given them a land, and you're not going to displace them. It's not for us to make determinations like that, is it? The Lord is the one, as Acts 17 says, who makes all nations and determines the bounds of their habitation. And so the Lord says, you may not have their land. Bypass Edom. And so they would move on. Now, interestingly, Numbers 21 tells us that Edom at first refused them passage through their territory and threatened them. Eventually, they apparently reneged and said, okay, yes, we'll sell you food and water. But here that's not mentioned. Here, they're just not to quarrel with them. And God is making the point. I've given to Edom their land. I've appointed for Edom their sphere. And I'm going to give you something else. And so they moved on. Verse 7, how could they trust that they were getting a good deal? I mean, if the people were afraid of them, and they needed stuff right then and there, why not go in and despoil the Edomites? Why not enrich themselves at their expense? Well, he says, verse 7, for the Lord your God has blessed you in all the work of your hand. He knows you're trudging through this great wilderness. These 40 years the Lord your God has been with you, and you have lacked nothing. How can we afford not to exploit the world? How can we afford as believers to behave ethically in business? Not to play by the world's rules. Not to cheat the other guy before he cheats us. Not to look out for numero uno always. Have to keep a little Spanish in once in a while to keep Henry interested, you know. How can we afford to do that? Are we coming out the loser? The Lord says, I provided for you all those 40 years in the desert. Not a supermarket, not even a measly convenience store in sight. And yet the Lord fed, perhaps, they numbered about 2 million people, many people estimate. He fed them. He gave them water to drink. He gave them clothes to wear. Their clothes would not wear out and their feet did not swell, this very book of Deuteronomy tells us. We can afford to let the other guy go. We can afford not to exploit his weaknesses because we have a God who provides. And that's a tremendous truth to be grasped, and they needed to grasp it. And when we passed beyond our brethren, the descendants of Esau, verse 8 says, we went on to Elath and Ezion-Geber, and we turned and passed by the way of the wilderness of Moab. Then the Lord said to me, do not harass Moab, nor contend with them in battle, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the descendants of Lot as a possession. And then if you come down for a moment to verse 19, and when you come in near the people of Ammon, do not harass them or meddle with them, for I will not give you any of the land of the people of Ammon as a possession, because I've given it to the descendants of Lot as a possession. So here you're to come by the Edomites, you're not to harass or meddle with them, you're not to harass the Moabites, the next people on your itinerary, you're not to harass the Ammonites after them. And if you think about the Moabites and the Ammonites in their history, they were the product of a most sordid episode in the history of the book of Genesis. When Lot, forgetting his pilgrim character, settled down in the city of Sodom and got himself elected to government, sitting in the city gate there, and yet wasn't able to sway the future or the fortunes, as we might say, of the city of Sodom. Rather, the judgment that overtook Sodom nearly overtook Lot, and would have, were it not that Peter points out to us in 2 Peter 2, that the Lord knows how to deliver the righteous. And we might not even believe Lot to be righteous, but for the fact that Peter says it over and over again to us. But you look at that story, and how the man who begins Genesis chapter 19, sitting in the gate, ends the chapter as a caveman, living in a cave, not saving 15% on car insurance, but sitting there utterly dejected and fearful with his two daughters, who have learned from their father that all that is important in life is Sodom. Sodom is their world. Because they say, there's not a man in all the earth to come in unto us and give us children. You mean there's not any more male members of Homo sapiens on the face of the earth in your day? Well, doubtless they knew there were other men on the face of the earth. But they had begun to think that there wasn't any man worth having who wasn't somebody in Sodom. What a great mistake that is. We have to be careful the values we're passing on to our children and the standards, that it's all about position in this world. It's all about riches in this world. It's all about connections forged in this world. It's all about being esteemed in this world. When our world, personally, becomes synonymous with the world, then we're in trouble. And no surprise then, that they used a Sodomish tactic. They made their father drunk, and they led him to the well-nigh to unspeakable sin of incest. And twice over, he became father, not only to his own sons, but in a sense they were his grandsons as well. An unspeakable thing. And yet they became mighty nations, Moab and Ammon. And as bad as their beginnings were, as messed up as that whole situation is, God says, I'm going to deal with those nations and I'm going to give them a place to dwell and I'm going to bless them in a certain degree. And you are not to take what they have. Because God makes the evaluation, as we already heard, based on His image in man. He makes the evaluation of what men and women may have and may not have. So you may not have Edom, you may not have Moab, you may not have Ammon. You have to bypass them in favor of what God is going to give you. Now we're nearly at the time of our break, but I'll just notice verse 10. The Emim had dwelt there, speaking of the land of Moab. And we read about these Emim, a people as great and numerous and tall as the Anakim. Now, Anak apparently originally meant neck, and some suggest it's the long-necked ones. It's a term for giants, the sons of Anak or the Anakim. They're also called Emim by the Moabites. And when you get down farther, you read that they're also called by the Ammonites the Zamzumim. And so they have, in verse 20 that would be, we have different names for this basic same group of people. They're all giants. And that's rather interesting to me, that each of these peoples knew about the giants. Each of these peoples had to contend with the giants. And they had different names for them. Emim means something like terrible ones. And the other names they have, you know, the Zamzumim, that has another meaning. I think it was cave dweller or something like that. And they called them different names based on what their languages were. But they all have the giants to face. And sometimes people get the idea, you know, that in this world, the only people that really have to go through problems and really have to face stuff are believers. People like me that were raised in a Christian home think, well, maybe it's easier out there in the world. Wouldn't it be easier not to be constrained by the morality of the Bible? Wouldn't it be easier to just live how I please and not care what God thinks? And the bottom line answer that the Bible gives to that is, no, it wouldn't be easier at all. You would still have the giants in your life. You would still have opposition. You would still have problems. Only, you're not promised any assurance of deliverance if you don't have the Lord. And yet to those who have the Lord, they could face the giants and they could look at them entirely differently, couldn't they? They could look at them and know that they were going to be victorious.